Hi, I'm Marianne Campbell. Welcome to the fourth in our series of eight talks given by Al Stewart for the City Bible Forum. If you've missed some of those talks, you can download them from www.reason4hope.com.au. Join me now, though, as we listen to Al speak on eternity in our hearts.
For everything, and a season for every activity under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. A time to embrace and a time to refrain. A time to search and a time to give up. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to mend. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace.
Well, I wonder what your morning has been like. Mine has been frantic. And I hate technology in one way, but I was very happy to get those extra few minutes to read through my talk and try and get it in my head. And I think I have had a time poor morning. It's a funny phrase, isn't it? Do you ever feel time poor? Because you see it around a lot now, particularly advertising to time poor people. And I think, well, wait a minute. We've all got kind of 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365. How can you be time poor? How does it happen? And yet, it seems like more and more the people I talk to feel pressured in the area of time. Now, the good news is that as technology gets quicker and quicker and quicker, that will help solve it, won't it? What if we could do things in half the time that it used to take us and do it quicker and quicker? That will mean we'll feel less pressured in the area of time. So, being a lover of technology, I went and did a little bit of research about how quickly the advance of technology has meant we can get things done faster and faster. Here's a quick timeline on just a few things that have happened in the last little while that really have helped speed things up. And this is, we can look forward to taking the pressure off us. In 1837, Samuel Morse invented the telegraph. 1876, Alexander Graham Bell invents the telephone. It was no use at all until he invented the second telephone. And then when he invented the third telephone, he rang and they were engaged. Anyway, that's not... In 1930, the analog computer was invented. 1942, the first electronic digital computer. In 1947, the first mobile phone was invented, I found out, but it wasn't marketed commercially until the 80s. 1948, the first telephone pager. 1956, the computer hard disk. 1958, the first modem invented. 1971, the cellular digital phone. 1988, the digital cellular phone invented. 1988, too, according to the website I checked, the first commercial email was used. And then 1990 is given as the launch date for the World Wide Web. And since then, things have been getting quicker and quicker, smaller and smaller, faster and faster. There's a Canadian training company called Priority who've done a survey around the world of 6,000 people involved in business and how they feel about their time. Here's what some of the conclusions were. The survey found also that there is more stress than satisfaction in today's workplace. 60% of respondents feel stressed 2 days or more a week. And a scant, get this, 5% say they feel a sense of personal accomplishment at the end of every day. Do you feel like sometimes you've been at work all day, worked really hard, and you've lost ground? I regularly go home thinking I've lost ground. Quote, technology makes us accessible at all times. But we are just starting to realise that just because you can be accessible doesn't mean you should be, explains the man who ran the study. The lines between our professional and personal lives are blurring thanks to cell phones, pages, email and the wireless revolution. Our survey shows that our personal lives are the losers. So I can remember seeing for the first time email and thinking, wow, if only I could have email. And then a mobile phone and thinking, if only I could have a mobile. Do you know what I think now? If only I didn't have email and a mobile, I could have a life. Yeah? Okay. Well, and it's not just a day-to-day struggle. It's kind of in the big picture of our lives. time. I want to know, why is it that every decade of your life goes by quicker than the one before? I turned 40 about 15 minutes ago, and I'm 47 next birthday. I can't wait till I hit the 50s if I notice them as they go past. Why is it that the days get longer and the years get shorter? And I want to know, why do we become like our parents? In terms of how we look and what we say and... anyway. And the midlife crisis, you know, we mock... well, actually, one sex mocks the other about midlife crisis. But what's the midlife crisis? It's that he turns 40-something, not 47, but he turns 40-something and then thinks, so much time's gone and so little done and so little time left, and what's life all about? And in some ways, that's the question we look at today. What is it in life that gives meaning and purpose and will last? Today, the book of Ecclesiastes in chapter 3 looks at the idea of time or seasons in life. How do you understand time in our lives, and how do we try and make sense of it? This is talk 4 in an 8-part series as we're working our way through the 12 chapters of the book. In case you haven't been with us, great to have you if this is your first time. Let me quickly get you up to speed as to kind of the structure or the big question of the book, and then we'll come to the section about time. Ecclesiastes is written possibly by King Solomon, the greatest king in ancient Israel, greatest, richest. If not written by him, then certainly through his eyes as he looks at the world. And what he's looking for is something that lasts, something that's meaningful, gives purpose. The book begins, chapter 1, verse 2, "Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless." That's his starting point, that's how life appears. The word meaningless, it's quite a good translation. The Hebrew word is hebel, which means originally a breath or a vapour. You know, a cold morning, you walk outside, breathe out, you can see your breath, and then it's gone. Or like the fog in the mornings when the sun hits it. It's there, it's pretty, it's nice, and then as soon as the sun comes up properly, it's gone. It's also used elsewhere, things that are worthless or trivial. The King James Bible translated it 400 years ago as vanity of vanities. Vanity in the sense of it's all pointless, it's all in vain. What he's saying is life is a vapour, it's transitory, it's here and then it's gone. Is there anything that lasts? What he does then is to ask the very next thing, to say, well, what is it that lasts under the sun? 1 verse 3, "What does man gain from all his labour at which he toils under the sun?" The gain word, it's a word from commerce. It means surplus. What's left over? What's left? We'd say today, what's the bottom line? What really lasts? And notice the little phrase, "under the sun." That's the key, I think, to understanding the book. Under the sun explains his worldview. And what he's saying is, if we just looked out under the sun, if the world was like a closed system, if we didn't have a word from God, if we couldn't communicate with God or he hadn't spoken to us, if all we had was our eyes and our common sense, what would we see in life? What would be the gain? What would be the surplus, the bottom line? If all there is what we see, what's the point? What's it all about? Well, he sets out to find what the gain, what's the bottom line, what's the profit, what lasts, what's permanent under the sun. And in the last 4 weeks, he's looked at pleasure, wisdom, work, possessions, and found really these things are nice and fun while they last, but they don't last. That's the problem. They're a vapour. They disappear. Now, in chapter 3, he comes today to a very famous poem. It's been a pop song too, and I won't sing it to you, I won't inflict that on you. But let me show you a very famous poem, and what it looks at is the events or the seasons of life. Here they are. Verse 2 is the biggest events, a time to be born and a time to die. Verse 3, creative and destructive, a time to plant and a time to uproot. The word doesn't mean harvest, it means rip plants out of the ground. Time to kill and time to heal, to tear down and to build. Emotions, public and private, joy and sorrow, and so on, in public and in private. And then verses 5 and 6, building and possessions, different aspects of that. Verse 7 about speaking, time to speak, time to be silent. Verse 8, personal relations and national relations. Personal, love and hate. National, peace and war. But that's a pretty heartless way to pull a poem apart, isn't it? Even I know that. the way to get a feel for a poem is to read it. So I'll read it to you and kick back, relax, and get the feel of it. What is it that Solomon's telling us? Here we go. Chapter 3, verse 1. There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. A time to embrace and a time to refrain. A time to search and a time to give up. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to mend. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. And what's the feel? What's it feel like? It feels like a pendulum or a metronome, okay? Backwards and forwards at a rhythm. It comes and it goes. And I think what he's saying to us is that life isn't an endless series of kind of meaningless minutes, like of unrelated minutes, one after another after another. Life is a series of seasons that come and go and ebb and flow. And it's a season for this, and then it's a season for that. And that's a way of understanding time. It's the events that are happening that help you understand what time it is. So you've got 14 pairs of events there, from the biggest things in our lives, birth and death, to smaller things like a time to sow and a time to mend, the personal things like love and hate, the national things, war and peace. And I think he's showing us that wisdom rests not so much in a particular action, as in it's time to buy, but wisdom rests in understanding the season. Is it the time to buy or is it the time to sell? On the stock exchange, anyone can buy and sell. It's not hard. It's the timing. Is it time to buy or time to sell or time to wait? There's all the difference in the world between understanding the times. Is it time to speak up or is it time to shut up? And the thing about being able, you know, your words and their power is not so much what you say as the timing. And I can always think of exactly the right thing to say about 24 hours later. But there's a proverb elsewhere in the Old Testament, the book of Proverbs, says, a man finds joy in giving an apt reply, and how good is a timely word. I've got a 13-year-old at home. She just nails my head to the coffee table all the time about different things because she can do it. And I, 24 hours later, it just doesn't. Anyway. I think what he's saying is one of the great secrets of life is realising the time or the season. And that is, you can fight against things and so on, but if it's the time for one thing, to try and do something else will be very hard. It's paddling upstream. It's going against the grain. And yet to understand, no, now is the time to go with the flow and do whatever, much more likely to succeed. Verse 11, we'll come to this in a moment. He's speaking of God here, about, you know, under the sun and yet God, you know, in our world. God has made everything beautiful in its time. I think what he means is the right event, the right thing at the right time is beautiful. That first cup of coffee in the morning, right? There's a barista, a lady barista downstairs in the building I work in who is just, she's a magician. She can make a flat white that just, industrial strength, and it's just beautiful. The first thing in the morning, sensational. That first smell of spring, the hug from someone you love when you haven't seen them for a while. The family get-together when you finally got them all around the one table. Closing the deal after long negotiations. Your roses flowering after you've taken so long to grow them. Or if you're a South African, that last try with 3 minutes to go on Saturday night, which just broke my heart. But could have been, if you're South African, beautiful, the right thing at the right time. And we try very hard to control our lives, though, don't we? We work hard. I read, well, first thing I did was buy a bigger diary because I thought it might give me more time, but that didn't work. So I went and read Stephen Covey, who incidentally I think is a very handsome man, don't you reckon? I think he's really... I read Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, and that was a help. It actually showed me, at least I knew some of the things I was doing wrong. I don't know if I can fix them, but at least I know where I'm not highly effective. So I bought his sequel called First Things First, and the second day I had it, I lost it. I left it on an aeroplane in the back of the seat, and I've kind of... It's very embarrassing to ring Lost Property at Qantas and say, I lost the book about getting my life organised, and it lost... Anyway, it never came back, but that was... So we try. We try. And yet, what does this poem say about our lives? It says so much of our lives we just don't control. Because nowhere in my big diary or your planner or your Palm Pilot or whatever, you will not write in a time to mourn, but it will come. You will not write in a time to weep, but it will come. You will not write in the bad times, but they will come. The good times and the bad times wash over us and we just... do not control them. Right down to the biggest events in our lives, our birth and our death, are beyond our control. And I wonder if we're meant to see one other thing, and that is, how far does a pendulum actually travel? Answer is, nowhere. Back and forwards, it never really moves. Right? Or the metronome, it doesn't travel anywhere. And I think Solomon's written this to show us that the swing of the pendulum actually cancels itself out. So we tear and we mend. What's achieved? Nothing. We laugh and we weep. We build and we tear down. We're born and we die. And one thing cancels the other out. And in the end, nothing is accomplished under the sun. Nothing is achieved, nothing changes. And so, 3 verse 9, he asks the same question as he asked right back at the beginning of the book. Basically the same words. What does the worker gain, same word, what's the bottom line? What does the worker gain from all his toil? We work, we go to bed tired, we wake up tired, we work hard. What's it all amount to? And what he does is he finds 4 problems under the sun in view of what he's just seen about times and seasons. Now, I'll have to go through them quite quickly that they're... It's not too complicated. And he keeps coming back under the sun to the same kind of half an answer. Let's see, what are the 4 problems? First problem, verse 10. I have seen the burden God has laid on men. What's the burden? What's the weight that he's put on us? He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men. Yet they cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. What's he say? It's his way, a poetic way of saying eternity in our hearts. He's saying we kind of know there's more than just this. Under the sun, we can't work it. You know, we can't see it exactly, but we know. That's why most people believe in God of some kind. Most people want to believe in the spiritual, the supernatural. It's hardwired into us. Paul Davies is certainly not a Christian, as far as I know. Dr. Davies isn't. But here's in his book, The Mind of God, listen to what this physicist says and then think about eternity in the hearts. He says, I cannot believe that our existence in this universe is a mere quirk of fate, an accident of history, an incidental blip in the great cosmic drama. Our involvement is too intimate. The physical species Homo may count for nothing, but the existence of mind in some organism on some planet in the universe is surely a fact of fundamental significance. Through conscious beings, the universe has generated self-awareness. This can be no trivial detail, no minor byproduct of mindless, purposeless forces. We are truly meant to be here. He can see it. There's more than just under the sun. And yet, he says, verse 11, we cannot fathom it. We can't work it out on our own. And so, an answer, if we can't work it out, we know there's something more than this. An answer, Solomon says, I know that there is nothing better for men than to be happy and do good while they live. He's saying, well, that's probably as good as it gets. That everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil, this is the gift of God. It's kind of a shallow, unthinking hedonism, but hey, that might be all there is, so if that's all there is, let's do it. A second problem. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it so that men will revere him. Whatever is... has already been, and what has been will be before, and God will call the past to account. From my reading, I think that last little bit in verse 15 means God will call the past back again. It's a bit like what we saw in the end of chapter 1, where he says nothing ever really changes, nothing ever happens, it's all the same, and the pendulum goes back and forwards and nothing different ever happens. What he's doing here, I've understood this a little better than when we did chapter 1. He's talking in terms of categories. And you could say, well, yeah, the space shuttle and computers, they're new things. Yes, but if you think in the category of the endless march of technology from the wheel to the space shuttle, they're not new, they're just an endless line of technological advances that do not meet our problems, don't solve the real problem. Or the assassination of John F. Kennedy, that's a one-off event, that's new, except it's one in a long line of assassination of political leaders, and it'll always happen. So nothing ever changes. And the third problem, I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. He's saying nothing ever happens, and what does happen is so often corrupt. There's an organisation called Transparency International. You can just go to the website, dial it in, Transparency International. And what they do, they're a kind of an international organisation that keeps an eye on corruption. And they printed an index where they ranked 200 or so of the world's countries from least corrupt to most corrupt. And Australia did pretty well. We were in kind of the top five of the least corrupt nations. But even in the best of the best, or right up near the top, we have the ICAC. The state's anti-corruption watchdog has launched an investigation following claims of corruption within the New South Wales local court system. And it said, and I don't think anyone's going to clasp their heart and fall over with surprise. Wherever there's power and authority and so on, corruption comes. And he says, I thought in my heart God will bring to judgment both the righteous and the wicked, for there will be a time for every activity and a time for every deed. If the pendulum swings, well, they're corrupt, they'll get justice. I don't think this means the last great judgment day. I think it's just intuitively, every dog has his day. But there's a problem with thinking everyone will get it eventually. Every dog has its day, because the fourth problem really is a problem. I also thought, as for men, God tests them so that they may see that they are like the animals. Man's fate is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so dies the other. All have the same breath. Man has no advantage over the animal. Everything is meaningless. We die, we're buried, it's all a vapour. And all go to the same place. All come from dust, and to dust all return. Who knows if the spirit of man rises upward and if the spirit of the animal goes down to the earth. That's the Stuart clan, my tribe, about 3 years ago on holidays. In the foreground is one of my best friends, Arnie. He is a Rhodesian Ridgeback. He was about 13 years old then, and oh, you should have seen him when he was young. 40 kilos of dynamite, the greatest dog a man ever had. We were mates, we ran miles and miles together, and about this time I knew it was time for him to make the one-way trip to the vets. His hips had gone, he was getting a bit senile. I remember saying to the kids, I'm going to have Arnie put down. And they said, Dad, you've told us that 3 times already in the last week. I said, I'm trying to get you ready for it. They said, no, you're not, you're trying to get yourself ready for it. And so I took him to the vets and I held his hand while my mate got the green needle. I still get twitchy and a bit emotional when I see someone walking a Ridgeback around. We've got a toy dog now, but anyway, that's another story. Who my wife has turned into a sook. But anyway, but Arnie, 40 kilos of dynamite, he grew old and died and he's buried, and sometime in the next 40 years, I'll die too and they'll bury me. And what's the difference? Can you see the human dilemma? And that is, we have eternity in our hearts and we die like our dogs. Or whatever pet it is that you have. Eternity in our hearts and we die like our pets. That is the dilemma. And so, what does Solomon say? Under the sun, remember, closed system. Under the sun, here's a kind of a half an answer. He says, so I saw that there is nothing better for a man than to enjoy his work, because this is his lot. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? Under the sun, who knows what will happen after us? Try and enjoy the ride. Don't think too much. And we'll build and we'll demolish. We'll laugh and we'll weep. We'll be born and we'll die. And nothing ever happens and it's all meaningless. Except, what if, let me just leave Ecclesiastes for a moment. What if there was an event that happened that we could know what happened beyond the grave? What if there was an event that actually took us beyond just under the sun? What if God really did intervene in human history? The New Testament writers are aware of this under-the-sun dilemma. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, the Apostle Paul writes to the Christians in the Greek town of Corinth. He says, if this is all there is, if life is only under the sun, he doesn't use that phrase, but that's what he means. If this is all there is, then he says, quote, he says, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die, if this is all there is. He says, however, we do not have to live that way. There is an event that gives us hope and knowledge about why there is eternity in our hearts. And what he says, that great event is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. That Jesus was crucified on the Friday and rose again on the Sunday morning. And what he says, that event proves Jesus' claims about himself. It proves that he conquered death. It proves that he is the one who can give us these answers. And what he says, everything about Christianity actually hangs on that event. I'll just give you the gist of his argument, and then you may wish to read it yourself later. He says, and if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. If Jesus didn't rise again, it's a joke to be a Christian. And if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile. You are still in your sins. Then those who have fallen asleep in Christ are lost. If only for this life we have hope in Christ, we are to be pitied more than all men. The whole of the Christian faith revolves around the fact that Jesus rose again, that he really is the Son of God, that he really did conquer death, that he can show us. Now here's the good news. These are events in history. They're provable or disprovable. They can't have happened for me and not happened for you. It's a historical question. And here's the thing. Eternity in our hearts, it's not an accident. God has put it there. And God has spoken to us through Jesus and given us the events of his life and particularly the resurrection so we can find the answer. You see, it's the resurrection of Jesus that offers hope beyond just an empty hedonism.